Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
And now joining us is Donna Kaufman. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Now Donna, now you've been around and writing books. How? Well, I know.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so she's been around.
Me and the Beach Boys.
Oh, so you're a Charlie Manson fan. Okay. So now I noticed your book, Final Exams, and how did you get to working the books with Cyril, actually? How did that happen?
Well, I had been a freelance true crime writer since the O.J. chase. What happened is, just to back it up, before that, I was working on the Arsenio Hall show as a comedy writer. And he quit the show. You know, darn it, it was a great gig. Yeah. And so I had to go clean out my office. So I thought, before I left the house, because this was the day, June 17th, 1994, that O.J. was to surrender himself to the police for the murders, suspected murders, of his ex-wife and of her friend. And so I thought, well, that'll be interesting to watch when I come home to unemployment. So I stuck in a new video, 8-hour video, and I hit record, and I went, cleaned out my office, and that's the day of the slow speed chase. Mm-hmm. So when I came home, I watched that and went, oh my gosh, I have a new career. I want in on that. So I contacted friends of mine who were with the National Enquirer, and I said, put me on your team. I'm ready for this. I want to do this case. I want to do all true crime, but, you know, this is what I want to begin with. And they said, okay. So I started writing that, and then shortly thereafter, JonBenet Ramsey, and every major true crime case I worked on. And in doing so, I always realized that the epicenter of any true crime is the autopsy. So I began calling Dr. Cyril Wecht for assistance in my articles, and he gave me gravitas and put it in plain language that my readers would enjoy and understand. And and I developed a friendship with him. He was so funny. He is so funny. He still is. By the way, he is the world-renowned forensic pathologist, a.k.a. medical examiner. He has personally performed 21,000 autopsies. I've only done two. And in both cases, the guys woke up before I could really get going. Oh. But anyway, that's another story. So he also has consulted on more than 40,000 other death cases, and he's a lawyer. So nobody has those credentials but Cyril Wecht. So we started writing books together, and what I am the one who get from all of his 60,000 cases, I choose the ones that are the juiciest and the most twisted. I always make sure there's prosecution and defense, good arguments on both sides. Or, you know, he'll work for either side. You know, he can pick and choose the cases he works on, and I pick and choose the ones to write about. And always making sure that the cause and nature of the death is different. So, you know, no two drowning cases in the same book, and no two, you know, gunshots and stabbings and all the ways that you can die, and whether it's suicide or murder or natural. Well, who cares about natural, right?
Yeah.
come on. I'm not selling books about natural death. I'm not Dr. Oz here.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we try to make sure that each of the cases has a real interesting cinematic almost descriptions of he has the medical information, and I go back and I get into the heads of the victims and the person who perpetrated the crime. And together we're like CSI and Criminal Minds. And I think our books each have 4 to 7 cases in each book. So our first one, and some of them are very famous cases, Anna Nicole Smith and her son in the first book, and two child murders in San Diego, California. And then there's a great case that he did. And this is all Cyril. You know, I came into it afterwards. Sometimes I will bring a case to him, or we'll both work on it separately and then come together for the book. But this was one of his. It was about a homicidal doctor during the Katrina, hurricane, and she ended up killing 32 viable patients. And thought she'd get away with it, and in fact, you know, cut to the end, she did get away with it. She involuntarily euthanized 32 patients. So anyway, things like that really get us mad. So then our second book is From Crime Scene to Courtroom, and that's about all interesting cases as well. Casey Anthony, Drew Peterson, Michael Jackson, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, and a couple other cases. And our third one is Final Exams, True Crime Cases of Cyril Wecht. And those are mostly, he's based in Pittsburgh, so these are all Pennsylvania-centric cases. And they're all very interesting. And there's a Canadian element in one of them that, yeah, shame on you for having a country that allowed what went on in this case. Oh, you have to read it. It's so sick. But anyway, so it really is. It's like one of the worst. So anyway, that's how we write is, together. And now we're working on a book about the Kennedy assassination, which Dr. Wecht has been, from just about the beginning, a vocal critic of the Warren Commission, which was that group of esteemed experts who came together to lie on behalf of the government and say that one person was responsible for this.
Yeah, he was working for the House Select Committee on the assassination, right?
Well, he testified for them. He didn't work on the panel because, well, He sort of did. You know, they anyway, that's all in the book. But he was a critic of them too. Let's just say, you can't pull one over on Dr. Cyril Weck. You know, he just knows too much, and he's not afraid to let it rip. Our book is getting into all of that, plus the media perfidy and the complicity of the media in promoting these BS stories is shameful. It's journalistic malpractice. So this book will be sizzling whenever it comes out.
And you said that he was, excuse me for interrupting, but you said that he was a really funny guy, and I thought it was interesting that they cast Albert Brooks as him in the movie Concussion.
Yes, in Concussion, yes. Yeah. Yeah, we love that. Yeah, we love that a lot, and he got to meet Albert, and that was a nice little touch.
Well, I was going to say, it must be really frustrating when you deal with cases like Casey Anthony, for instance. Because you kind of know what the truth is from evidence, but yet the court and the media all have different takes, and of course, how it comes out is not necessarily how it should be.
Yeah. Oh, I tell you, true crime trials, they'll break your heart. You know, I mean, I learned that on OJ, the first criminal trial. I mean, you can't imagine how I went to bed that night saying, we got him. You know, case closed, we got him. And, whoa, who knew? Who knew that a jury that heard evidence for 10 months would deliberate for 3 hours, which included their lunch? So they take an hour for lunch during their deliberation, and not ask for anything to be read back or reviewed. They had been sequestered the whole time. They wanted to get home. But the other thing is they saw something fishy, and they picked up on it. So I actually agree with the jury. Now that I know the facts about what happened, they caught one of the cops doing something sleazy, and they let OJ go as a result. But, you know, the civil trial helped to write that, and he's never paid much in the way of the financial burden he owes the victims' families.
Yeah, probably never will.
No.
So, you know, what's your thought on the media then and how it handles this? And do you think that a lot of these trials should be kept from the public until after they're finished?
No. Oh, God, no. I love what, I mean, I mourn the loss of court TV, which I guess is coming back in some limping way. But, you know, the whole Casey Anthony trial, gavel to gavel. I mean, it was like I was in the courtroom for that. And that was just, that's where I just shine. I love that. You know, I'm not somebody who understands sports. I've never attended a sporting event. But this is as close to sports adoration as anyone can get, I think, if you're someone who follows the trial. Because, you know, oh, that attorney, and then you start talking about his stats and the games he's played and stuff, and then you, oh, that judge, well, you know, it's like the umpire that you know, you know, the players and everybody has a component that would be similar to a baseball game or something like that. So sometimes, you know, you go, and sometimes I'm actually in the courtroom. For the Scott Peterson trial, I was there for much of it. So it's all very interesting to me.
I'm the same way. I watch the court TV the way most guys watch football, so I understand.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you. I love that, especially from a dude. That's wonderful.
No, I love it too, actually. I can't take my eyes off it when I find a court TV case that's on YouTube or anything. I'll watch the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great stuff. And when I talked about this in book two, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, when Casey Anthony was found not guilty, I had my windows open, and I heard a shriek throughout my neighborhood, like, you know, like a bomb dropped. I mean, it was just, you know, I thought, oh, I'm really glad I live where I'm at. I know what these people, in fact, I probably contributed to it. So that was kind of a funny moment in a terrible, tragic case.
But don't you think that I sort of see how they play to the media, but, you know, even right back to the O.J. Simpson case, how could the judge and the defense and all that really do their job when they're focused on what they're wearing and what people are saying about them?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they have to. I mean, you know, we're going to have more cameras in courtrooms as we go forward than fewer. That right is going to extend to the Supreme Court one of these days, and we're all the beneficiaries of that happening. So, you know, you just have to deal with it. If they play to the cameras, well, then we'll note that about them. But that's just how it has to be.
He's going to be a mess if they're filming him. I hope he doesn't cry.
Well, as long as there's beer, he'll be stable.
Yeah, and Biff God. And whatever. Now you were just on that ABC special 2020, and it was on the Phil Hartman case, who we're all familiar with. He was a comedian and had a pretty successful career. How did you know the couple?
Well, I go back to Phil from before my comedy writing days for Arsenio. I was on a bunch of other shows, and as I was working my way up the television production ladder, I co-created the Pee Wee Herman show with Pee Wee, and Phil was the first person we brought in to the cast, and he came up with that song about washing your hands. And he was Captain Carl, who was happier out at sea than he was on land. And it was basically Phil's character. I didn't realize that at the time. So I got to know Phil very well from that. He was in the Groundlings, as was Paul Reubens. And many of our cast members, if not all, were taken from the Groundlings, which is kind of the primary improv group in Los Angeles, and, you know, they ended up contributing to the casts of SNL and other comedy shows, you know, since the 80s. So we put together this show, and so that's where I got to know Phil very well. And I remember being at his house one day, and he said, oh, you know, I got some toys I want to show you. And I thought, okay, so he goes in his bedroom and he brings out three guns that he sets on the coffee table. And now, I wasn't expecting that for toys. I said,
no.
You know, these are not toys. You're not a cop and you're not in the military, and I'm getting creeped out and I'll see you later. And I left because I was inconsistent with the pot-smoking hippie I knew. And this is a time when he was still doing art. He was a very fine graphic artist. And, you know, just kind of getting little acting jobs here and there. But, you know, that's sort of, I tucked that away, and we still maintained a friendship, and we were just, you know, great friends, and we would help each other out, you know, on comedy projects, and I would get him jobs on, as an announcer on various shows and stuff. So then he joined the cast of SNL and became what Lorne Michaels, the executive producer, called the glue. He was just so transforming in the many, many characters he could do and the voices he could do. And one of the things they show in the ABC special is his audition tape, which is hilarious. I won't blow the joke, but go to YouTube and look at Phil Hartman SNL audition, and it's just the best. So you could see why he got hired, and shortly thereafter, I joined the SNL writing staff, And so I got to know him. By that time, he was married to wife number three, who was Brynn. So I got to know her on that in New York. And then I finished with SNL, and I moved back because I was just staying in a hotel while I was on SNL, flying in and out for the shows. And then I moved back to L.A. and took another job. And then he ended up doing one more season at SNL, and then he and Brynn, and by now they had two little children, moved back to Los Angeles, where they had a lovely home. And so I got to know them there. And then later he joined the cast of News Radio, which was a sitcom on NBC. NBC basically wrote him a check and said, whatever you want to do, prime time, because Phil wanted prime time. He did not want to be on late night money, because there's a big difference between late night and prime time. Mm-hmm. So he was also getting movie roles, and he was on The Simpsons, which tapes out in Los Angeles. So he needed to be in L.A. And so he wanted me to develop a show for NBC for him. And Brynn had been promised from the beginning. She was trying to be an actress. She was an exquisitely beautiful model. When he first met her, she was an underwear model and swimsuit model. So he fell in love with, you know, this having this woman on his at his side on the red carpets. He just loved the fact that, you know, he had this fantastic looking specimen of humanity next to him. And but, you know, she always made it clear that she wanted to be an actress, and he said, stick with me, baby, I'll help you get roles. And he never did that. And in fact, he purposely lost roles for her. He would undermine her at every opportunity, and she got very depressed and started going back to bad habits she had before she met Phil, which was cocaine and alcohol. And she had been in and out of rehab a couple of times. I didn't know any of that when I first met her in New York. But, you know, I liked her a lot, and I thought she had potential as an actress. So when I spoke to Phil about the kind of show he wanted to create for NBC, he said, well, you know, sort of base it on the Jack Benny Show, which was an old black and white sitcom of the 60s. And where Jack played different characters, and his wife was on the show for a while, and it was their home life and his professional life, and it was just surreal. It's still on in repeats on television. If you have antenna TV, they air the shows, and they are the trippiest sitcom. The humor holds up to this day. It's just wonderful stuff with, you know, big stars coming in each week, and just the craziest writing in the world. So we were on the same page in terms of creating that kind of a show, and he liked what I was putting together. And then all of a sudden he said, oh, you know, I'm going to take this job on News Radio. I can't do it. I can't do our own show. And it was like, oh, well, thanks. And then, you know, also Brynn came to me and said, that's because he doesn't want to work with me. And I said, oh, come on, that can't be true. And she said, no, it's true. Then she wrote a script with a friend and said, here's the script, Phil. Would you give it to your agent and maybe he could sell? And he reads the script. He said, this is trash. I'm not going to give it to my agent. Well, I'm sorry. Agents read bad things all the time. I don't know whether it was bad or not. But the point is, Phil did not want her to be out of the home. He wanted her in the home, taking care of the kids. And that was not what he promised her when she joined his escapade. So I felt really bad for her, and I thought it was...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Not fair. And I say this as Phil's biggest fan. I really liked him. But one of the points the ABC show makes is that he was a distant guy. He would rather be on his boat or, you know, in his plane. He did not take, let's have a talk, and he did not look at that as, oh, great, an invitation to clear the air. No, he would go into his shell and ignore everyone, and usually that meant Bryn. So she could not get him to engage in any dialogue. And it was very frustrating for her, and so that was happening at that time, and it was sad. So anyway, cut to the chase is in May 28th, 1998, in a cocaine alcohol fueled frenzy, she shot him while he was sleeping in bed, two shots to the head and one to the chest. And killed him, then went to a friend's house and said, I did this. And he came back and verified that he was dead, called the police. And then she locked the door and the cops came, flooded the house. Instead of calling because they knew she was in the room and she had a gun in that room. A gun, by the way, she had just turned 40. The month before, and for her birthday, Phil gave her a gun. So that was a gun that she put in her mouth and pulled the trigger. So the cops had been all over that house. And when I was, I happened to be watching the news that morning. It was after 6 in the morning, and the first report said, there's a homicide at Phil Hartman's house. And because I remember he was a gun person, I called my friend who also knew him, and I said, oh, my God, he killed her. I can't believe it. Well, then more info came out, and we learned what really happened. But when she was in that bedroom, and there was no saving Phil because they had already confirmed that he was dead, they should have gotten a hostage negotiator, preferably a female there, to talk her down and tell her about her children, and you know they're out of the house now, but they're still in your life. You know, come out, let us help you. Instead, the cops gave the order like a SWAT team and broke through the window of her bedroom where she was laying next to Phil's dead body, and it scared her, and that's when she shot herself. So I will always hold those cops to blame, because she should have gone to trial, she should have been convicted, she should have gotten a sentence with some mitigation for the extreme mental anguish that he put her through for 20 years, and not quite 20, but, you know, long enough. By the time we get to trial, it would have been, you know, that long. And she should be out and being a grandmother to her children. Instead, they're orphans. And the kids were taken in and adopted by her sister and her husband, who just did a remarkably great job in raising these lovely children. And they live in the Midwest, and they're adults now, 31 and 27. And they live very well. So the for the first time, her brother also spoke to ABC, and that's a very interesting interview. So
yeah,
anyway, you can jump in here anytime.
Yeah,
it's
good to get the premise. I'm just sort of surprised. I always thought they were happy together. I didn't realize that he, like you were saying, he's kind of abusive to her, I guess, mentally. So when
he would, you know, here's a woman that he met because she was a swimsuit model and perfect looking, and then as soon as they got married, you know, he was like saying, you know, you're looking old, maybe you need plastic surgery, and she would run to a plastic surgeon and have multiple surgeries. So he was always undermining her and picking on her looks, which was absurd. So that's another thing that, you know, was just why? But, you can't take away his talent except as a husband.
Yeah. Oh, so why is it that you think that she ended up shooting him? Was it just from years of this type of treatment?
She had almost a double blood alcohol content, and she had cocaine, not a lot of it, but a little cocaine in her system, and she was on Zoloft, which was an antidepressant, which was prescribed to her. It was in a therapeutic amount, but pretty much you look at the label, it says, do not mix with alcohol and cocaine, Bryn. And, you know, so her brother...
She was in and out of recovery, too, was she not?
Yes.
She was.
And she was... He wanted her to go back. And she just was really, really depressed. And, you know, he didn't know what to do, but, you know, he didn't understand why she just couldn't pick herself up and go on. I mean, they had help with the kids. You know, they had nannies and housekeepers and all that, so she had a pretty sweet life. But everything but the thing that she wanted, which was to be creative.
And so when you mentioned that he took out guns, you know, years previously and showed you his toys, what do you think he was trying to represent to you?
Well, I think he was letting me know that he's a guy who likes guns. I mean, he's a guy who had... had an airplane. He had two boats when I knew him. He was a guy who liked sports cars, Ferraris and Porsches, and, you know, he just thought of guns as more toys. He wanted me to go to a shooting range with him, and I just refused. I'm not from that culture. I'm from San Francisco. We don't do that. You know, we're just not that. I don't know where he developed his love of guns, but it turned me off, and I you know, I'm not saying that they were AR-15s or, right, you know,
yeah,
Kalashnikovs or anything like that.
Yeah.
But they were something I had never seen. No, I had never been to a house where somebody said, hey, look at these toys, and, you know, let's take them apart and clean them and play with them. And I thought, Nope, not me. No, me.
Now, did you think Bryn was into it, or was she a collector?
You know,
of
that's
guns,
a good
or?
Question. I would have loved to know. He said that he took her. He said not to me, but to other people that they would go to a gun range, so she knew how to use a gun, and that was. He said, I bought her a gun on her 40th birthday for protection because I'm gone all the time. Well, they lived in a very, not a private community, but a wealthy community. So I don't know who they were being protected from. You know, I just think it was part of his life and maybe hers. I mean, she was from Minnesota, so maybe there's hunting in her family. I don't know, maybe she was somebody who was raised around guns, I'm not sure. But the gun that he gave her for her 40th is the one that she used on herself. And another gun of his, probably one of the ones he showed me as a toy, was the one she used on him, a 38.
Mm. Now, he said that he had, in the special that I watched last night, he said that he had been the victim of an extortion attempt and some other things. Do you think that was part of the reason he felt he needed a gun?
No. I think, no, because when he had the guns that he showed me, that was 20 years before, or 15 years or something like that.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think that he just had guns in his life as a regular course. And, you know, I mean, people own guns. I know that, you know. So, but I think it was just part of his life.
There is a story about Bryn and cocaine and Andy Dick.
Do
you have any familiarity with that?
Yeah, yeah. Andy, at some point, they were on news radio. He was on news radio at the time, and they were at a Christmas party at Phil's home, and he said to Bryn, hey, I got some cocaine. You want some? Yes, I do. So he gave her some, and then Phil found out about it, and also John Lovitz found out about it, and were furious at Andy for giving her cocaine. Well, he didn't know about her background of being in and out of rehab. He just thought, hey, I'm going to have a little bump. Would you like one? You know, happy Christmas. It could be an eggnog, but it's not. And I remember being on SNL in the ladies' room, walking in, and there she is, you know, taking cocaine, and she offered me some, and I thought, well, you know, I mean, this is, I never thought, oh, she's got a problem. Never. That never occurred to me, because I didn't know her rehab background, or I didn't know her addictions. If I had, I probably would have said something to him. But, so I think that Andy just, you know, did that, and then later after she died, John Lovitz got into his mind that that action of 10 months previous was what set the path for Bryn, and she wouldn't have had anything else in her mind when she killed Phil except wanting to avenge you know, the fact that he was sending her back to rehab again. And that's just crazy. I mean, I was, the night that Phil and Bryn died, I was at John Lovitz's house. He had a few people over, and he was really angry about that. And I kept thinking, you know, it really does, I don't see the connection. But at some point, he actually tried to have a physical fight with Andy, and I don't know why he just fixated on that having some relevance and ignored everything else. People in show business tend to only see the loss of Phil as, you know, the be-all, end-all. And because, you know, he was so important to show business, and he was. But, you know, there were two people here that left two little children, and this whole thing was a tragedy from all directions.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you. I noticed that in the documentary, they talked about how Brin's brother tried to sue the Pfizer Corporation over how they claimed that the Zoloft had affected her. But also in the documentary, there were people who said that Phil Hartman told them long before that that she was violent towards him and would hit him and throw things at him. So I think the attempt to find an explanation, you know, we're probably never going to know exactly why, but it sounds like there's more to it than just she was on Zoloft or she was on cocaine or whatever that particular night.
Yeah, she had anger issues that I hadn't known about. She never displayed anything like that when I was in her presence. But she did to other people, and Lisa, Phil's second wife, said that she sent her a violent letter. But Lisa has said, direct quotes, last night she said it was a two-page letter. Before she said it was a four-page letter. So I don't know.
And she said that Phil, when she talked to Phil about it, he said, well, you should have seen the letter she was going to send you. Like, it was even worse than that one.
Yeah. I mean, then in that case, why didn't Phil say, hey, I'll take this to the post office for you and then, you know, rip up the letter? Mm-hmm. Was there a part of him that enjoyed seeing these two wives at war? That was what occurred to me, is that, you know, he was sort of enjoying that catfight, encouraging it.
And he was seeing his ex-wife as a friend at the time, hiding it from
Brin. That's what she says, and that he was parking around the block, and, you know, I really don't think that Phil had any female friends. Maybe, you know, he did continue a friendly relationship with her. Maybe that was of some comfort. Was Brin abusive toward him physically? Probably. You know, you could not get Phil's attention unless you were pretty bold. You know, Phil just wasn't going to talk to people. He just didn't engage. Lisa tells a story that on Valentine's Day she bought some sexy lingerie when they were married and danced around it, and he just said, oh, really? Come on. And she took it off and put it back in the box and went and read a book. You know, there was nothing that you could say to get Phil to engage in any way. So, this was the problem he had with women. I guess it must have happened with his first wife as well. She's never been public. But it wasn't easy being Phil's wife. And, you know, he had to read scripts, he had to do meetings, he was away on sets, he was building his career, all of which is fine. You know, there's one thing, if you remember the opening credits for SNL when Phil was on it, he's at a diner, and sitting next to him is a blonde, and you see her earring going back and forth. You don't see her face. Yeah. That was Brin. And Phil could have said to the director, hey, put the camera over there so you get her beautiful face in this, too. But he didn't. You know, so she's in every episode, but you never see her face. So for somebody who could have helped her acting career, he didn't do that.
In the show last night, one of his friends said that he had said repeatedly that he did not think she was a good actor. And maybe he was trying to prevent her from embarrassing him, or at least in his eyes. But I think it's interesting.
Well, I don't know that she would embarrass. She was fine. I worked with her, and I think the reason that she enjoyed working with females is because we didn't have that thing like, oh, okay, you say she's no good, okay, fine, I'll trust what Phil says, he's the master. No, I could tell you she was as good as any other actress that I could have worked with in a sketch comedy kind of role. So that was unfair. That I think he just didn't want the competition. Mm-hmm. you know, she got very depressed because they would be on the red carpet, and everyone would just look through her and talk to Phil. And in the ABC special, it shows one time where he spells her name out, and like, oh, God, he just threw her a bone. But, you know, that's not the same thing as having, you know, he had management. He had, he was in the catbird seat with producers, directors, writers, agents, managers, you know, studio heads. He could have done anything to say, hey, give her, you know, throw her a bone here, do something for me, give my wife a job. And he purposely said, don't hire my wife. I mean, no wonder she was mad. Not excusing her behavior, but I'm saying, you know, she went into this relationship with that promise that he would help her, and then he did everything to, you know, oh, honey, your face looks really round. Maybe you should do something about that, and should run and get more plastic surgery.
Mm.
So,
what do you hope people come away with when they see the special and when they hear about the Phil Hartman case?
Well, I have one goal when I do these shows, which is I hope one day the kids hear what I say, because I want them to know that she was a loving mom, and that both parents were loving. They did love. You know, Phil wasn't around much, but when he was great creative person, and she was as well, and that they have directly inherited some of their very best traits, and that this was a, you know, horrendous episode that happened. One day we all wish we could turn back, but, you know, they were good people. The mom was a good person, and you know, they didn't do this out of hatred. She was in an altered state.
And just before she killed herself, didn't she call her sister to ask her to take care of the children?
Yes. That was a lucky thing that she did that, because the guy who went back to the house with her to assert that Phil was dead had the gun that she used on Phil. He took it away when it fell out of her purse at his home. He grabbed the gun, put it aside, and gave it to the police. So his handprints were all over that gun. If she didn't establish those phone calls to her sister and others, he would have been the suspect.
Yeah. I thought about that last night when he's on the phone. Ron Douglas was his name when he was on
Ron
the phone.
Ron Douglas, yeah.
Say, where is the gun? And he says, it's in my hand. And, like, that doesn't seem like the smartest thing to be doing, but, yeah.
Yeah, yes. Well, she opened her purse, it fell out, and he grabbed it. So, but at that point, he still thought that she was full of beans, that, oh, you didn't really kill Phil, come on. I'm taking my car, you take your car, we'll go back over there and see what's what. And then, you know, he saw that Phil was dead. He left the room to go call the police, and she locked the door and stayed in that bedroom until the cops broke the window, and then we heard the gunshot. By the way, when there were so many cops there, way more than they needed, it was like and thank God this was before cell phone cameras, because they'd be, all these cops would be posing with the corpses. I'm not kidding. There were at least 30 cops there. They were calling friends, cop friends, and saying, hey, come on over, look at this. And meanwhile, the coroner's office calls the lead detective and says, is there something we should know over there? We're hearing rumors that you may have a couple of dead bodies. Oh, yeah, well, we're going to call you. This was 5 hours later. They were too busy, you know, gawking and calling their buddies to come look, than to call the coroner and say, you know, come and, you know, look at the scene and take these bodies. So, which eventually happened, but, you know,
that's
it was
just
was
yeah.
Bad police, and I'm a huge proponent of LAPD and the work they do, all cops, but this was not kosher.
No, no, not a good thing. It's been a real pleasure having you on, and your work is fantastic. And our guest has been Donna Kaufman. Thank you for being here, Donna.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate this.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.